The crisis in Syria has been in the headlines for weeks, but the roots of the two-year-long conflict can be traced back decades. This hour, how Syria got to this point and where it might go from here. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we want to talk with a few people in Iowa who have the expertise about Syria to give us a more in-depth picture of how the history of the region brought the crisis to this point, how terrorism figures into it, and what eventual outcomes of the conflict might be. My guests, Jean-Pierre Tautel of Iowa State University, Brian Lai of the University of Iowa, who specializes in terrorism, and historian Charles Dobbs of Iowa State University. Behind the headlines of the Syrian crisis, after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The crisis in Syria has been dominating our headlines for the past few weeks, but the latest developments from a breaking news perspective are only one part of understanding the Syrian civil war. This hour, we want to talk with a few people in Iowa who have the expertise about Syria to give us a broader picture, a picture of the history of the region that brought the crisis to this point, but also talk about the various factions at work in the area and possible outcomes and what it means for us here in the United States. Joining us first of all this hour, Jean-Pierre Tautel. He is a senior lecturer of French at Iowa State University. He was born in Syria, grew up in Lebanon. He teaches at Iowa State University language classes in French and Arabic. Also in the honors program, he teaches seminars on conflicts in the Middle East and teaches about sustainability in the Middle East. Jean-Pierre Tautel, welcome to our program.
Thanks.
Let's go back to a previous revolt by the Syrian people. Our listeners may remember this from the early 1980s when Hafez al-Assad was in power. He was the father of the current leader, Bashar al-Assad, and there was an uprising in Hama. This is part of Syria. Tell us, what happened during that revolt?
This uprising happened in 1982, in February, like for around 27, 28 days, where the Muslim Brotherhood were trying to change the regime. And then the response of the father of Assad, Hafez al-Assad, was to crush the uprising. So what they did, basically, there was a warning given to the inhabitants of the city to leave the city, and the idea was whoever stays in the city would be a terrorist. After this warning was given, the city was bombarded. At this time, there was no internet. You couldn't have all the information right away. But according to analysts and news reporters, there were around 20 to 40,000 people who were killed during this crushing the uprising.
And of course, in 1982, we didn't have the transparency that we have from our internet age, where we know what's going on in the world 24/7, 20 to 40,000 people were killed.
Yes, I mean, the number 20,000, kind of everyone agrees on this number. Now, when you go online and you look for this event, the number can vary between 20 to 40,000.
Mm-hmm. Help us understand what the tension was, the conflict between Hafez al-Assad and the Muslim Brotherhood. Both of these groups are Muslim, so what is the difference in their vision of how the country should be run?
Well, Hafez al-Assad belongs to a minority that is called the Alawites, and they represent around 12% of the Syrian population. And the Muslim Brotherhood are more Sunnis, which is the majority of the Syrians. So there was this idea of having the minority ruling when it should be the power should be given to the majority, according to the Muslim Brotherhood. And there was also the idea to change the regime and install maybe a new regime. I don't know what kind of color would be this new regime, but there was an uprising happening at this time.
Mm-hmm. And so what happened after that revolt? The Muslim Brotherhood went underground, or what happened to them?
Yeah, I mean, completely. They were completely crushed, went underground. A lot of people were arrested, put in jail, and basically you couldn't do anything anymore.
You were living in Lebanon at this time? You were how old?
I was in Lebanon at this time. I was a teenager in Lebanon.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any memories, distinct memories from this period of
I mean,
of that?
Yes, of course, because at this time, you couldn't see anything in the news. It was more what people would tell, and travelers would come back and say, there was a lot of, demolition in the city, and a lot of people died. But these were not things you could confirm. You learn about them a year or 2 years later when you can travel and see the destruction.
So after that, how did this Hama uprising change Syria and the region after that?
Well, it just confirmed the power of the President Assad. It was clear message that was given to anyone who was going to challenge his power that he was willing to completely destroy everything. I mean, it's a few sentences. It's me or nobody. So you have to choose between being killed or keep me in power.
Why did the uprising last in 1982 for only a month, but now in 2011, spiraling into a civil war continuing into 2013?
Because in 1982, the uprising only happened in one city. So it was easier to crash the uprising. In 2011, with the idea of the Arab Spring, you had demonstrations happening in many cities. It started in the south of Syria, in south of Damascus, in a city called Deraa. And then this was spreading widely very quickly in other cities. And there's also the whole, I think, the whole movement of the Arab Spring, where people thought, well, this is happening in Egypt, it happened in Libya, well, it's our turn, we can go in the street. Maybe people didn't think that the same scenario would happen as in 1982, that the regime would respond with a very, very harsh response. Because if you look at the beginning of the revolt, people didn't go in the street to ask for a change of a regime. At the beginning, it was more revolt demonstrations for reforms. They were asking for some reforms. Mm-hmm. And then they were met with police shooting at them. And little by little, these people who kept going in the street and being shot came to the idea. I mean, it's like, okay, now it's time to take the arms. You can be in the street demonstrating and being shot every day.
So what were the specific reforms that they were wanting?
Some of the reforms were more related to, for example, corruption. Could be social reforms. It was not really a change for the regime. I mean, if you look at the first slogans, nobody went on the street to say, down with Assad. At the beginning, if the regime had listened to them, it wouldn't be to this point where we are today.
At the beginning of this recent conflict, the recent civil war, what part does the Muslim Brotherhood play in this war?
I mean, it's a political party, the Muslim Brotherhood. So you have maybe a lot of people who are willing to support this party and would like to see a change. Now, you have people maybe who are not really convinced, but they are also tired of 40, 50 years of the same president and then his son. If you put it in certain context, for someone who doesn't know much about Syria, I would just give an analogy. You know, imagine you are someone who is Republican and then you have Obama president for 40, 50 years. Or if you are a Democrat and then you have President Bush, who is the president for 40 years, 50 years. So people are willing to go on the street for something new. They don't know what it is exactly. They have some trust in the Muslim Brotherhood because it's one of those parties who was crushed, who comes with new ideas.
When we compare the two leaders, the father, Hafez al-Assad, who died in 2000 with his son, Bashar, what do you see in terms of differences and similarities between them?
You have to keep something in mind, is whether it was in 1982 or today, it's the survival of the regime. So in 1982, the response of Assad to crash the uprising by bombarding a whole city, even if it had to lead to 20,000 people dying, it was like, if this doesn't happen, I might be overthrown. And today you see the same thing. I mean, Assad's son knows very well that it's whether he stays in power or he has no place in this country. So it's a survival reaction.
When Bashar al-Assad succeeded his father, I remember there was some hope that he would be a reformer. It was a short-lived hope, I think. Why did people think this?
Well, first of all, he was not the one who was supposed to be the president. It was his brother, but his brother died in a car accident. So basically, Hafez al-Assad had to form his other son, Bashar, who was a doctor studying, ophthalmology in London. So when he came back and was called and right away was in the army, I mean, people thought that, well, he has lived abroad, so he comes with the new ideas. I mean, if you compare with the father, who rarely used to travel, mostly he used to meet everyone in Damascus. He didn't travel that much. And you had someone who had been abroad. So people maybe thought, well, if he's been abroad, if he's lived abroad, he would come with new ideas, especially in the West, in London. And effectively, when he came into power in the year 2000, there was what we call the Damascus Spring, where some freedom of speech were given. People were allowed to meet and discuss in groups, which was forbidden. I mean, remember Syria until last year, or maybe 2 years ago, I mean, I don't have the date exactly, it has always been under martial rule. So basically, you cannot meet in groups, you cannot discuss things unless you have some agreement from the government. This didn't last too long. And right away after, some people were started to be arrested. And the main reason, from analysts who have been looking at the situation, sometimes we wonder if he really have all the power or not, because it's the whole system. So you can have a new president, but then you have who is around him, who are older than him, who have been with his father, the whole cabinet, the whole bureau around him. Mm-hmm. So is he really free to do what he wants? That's the main question. And this is where people start doubting if he was really the person ruling or it was more a cabinet around him.
So when you look to the future, what do you see? What are the open questions for you that you will look to see to be answered?
It's hard to imagine Assad taking back the whole country and coming back to power as he was before. It will be very, very hard to imagine Assad winning the war. And, you know, in 2-3 years down the road, we would just talk about there was an uprising in Syria for 2-3 years. And then finally, the regime could, you know, crash it again with all the military and the arms they had. Because if you think about it, today you have at least maybe one-third. Because now you have people who say, well, two-thirds of the population is with Assad. But you still have one-third of the population who is against Assad. So these people have demonstrated. They have written a lot of things on Facebook, you know, social media. They have been in demonstrations. So what do you do with one-third of these people? If Assad takes back and wins, you can be sure that this one-third of people will be all, this will disappear. I mean, they will be killed as simply as this. So, I mean, it's a point where both parties are fighting for their survival today. And maybe a division of Syria, unfortunately. Maybe in the long term, there will be some, you know, some maybe coup d'etat or some reaction within the Assad. People around him would look at the situation and say, okay, we need to do something.
Perhaps we'll check back in with you, Jean-Pierre Tautel, senior lecturer at Iowa State University. Thank you so much for these insights, Jean-Pierre.
Sure. You're welcome.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and today we're talking with a few people in Iowa with some interesting perspectives on the Syrian crisis. Next, terrorism's role in the Syrian civil war. And my next guest is Brian Lai, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Brian Lai specializes in terrorism and conflict processes. Professor Lai, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
Yesterday, and this just hours before a meeting between the top Russian and U.S. diplomats to discuss Syria, the Russian President Vladimir Putin published an op-ed in the New York Times explaining why military action in Syria is the wrong move. And he wrote, among other things, that it would increase violence and unleash a new wave of terrorism. What do you think of Putin's warning? Valid?
To some degree. I mean, so Putin's drawing on sort of historical concerns or historical precedent we've seen in which you have a lot of foreign fighters spilling into Syria right now to oppose the Assad regime, including Chechen groups. So there are some Chechen groups who have assisted Syrian rebels. And so the fear is similar to what we saw in Afghanistan in the 90s, in that you have a huge pool of foreign fighters show up. And then when the war is over, you now have this sort of big pool of very sort of radicalized fighters who are willing now to go anywhere and oppose other regimes. And so that's sort of his concern, is that, you know, if you further destabilize the Assad regime, then you'll sort of help these foreign fighters who are particularly radicalized. And then when they're done, they might spread to go to other countries.
Mm-hmm. You didn't mention Iraq. Wasn't that the case in Iraq as well?
Sure, in Iraq as well. I mean, so Iraq was interesting in that the foreign fighters came in, and really, I guess they're still sort of there. Mm-hmm. But so Iraq, to some degree, because actually a lot of the Syrian, a lot of the groups that the U.S. considers terrorists who are in Syria got their start in Iraq. So, yeah, Iraq is another good example of that.
Now, what about this warning in regard to terrorists' actions outside of that region? I mean, would it increase the likelihood, the concern that we should have about terrorists in the United States or other areas where the U.S. is present in the world?
Well, there's sort of two concerns. I mean, so one is the long-term concern that Putin's expressing, and that's this idea that down the road, this is a training ground, and so we don't know what will happen to these people who are training right now. So that's a concern. It's for the U.S. It's sort of diffuse. That is, you know, Obama sort of mentioned this in his speech in the sense that he said, you know, there are a lot of threats, many of which we deal with now. So today we already deal with the threat of terrorism, and so it's there. So that's sort of a very diffuse long-term threat. I mean, there is a sort of a warning from, say, Assad and Iran and Hezbollah that sort of implicitly there might be a short-term threat in the sense that if we attack Syria, they might activate some of their terrorist allies to strike U.S. or U.S. interests more immediately.
Mm-hmm. Because I'm wondering, in the case that those terrorists who would like to harm the U.S., they're holding back, waiting for a provocation. I thought they would have been dedicated to harming the U.S. whenever and however they can in the present.
They are. And so I think the issue wouldn't be so much that they're sort of just waiting. The issue probably would be that someone like Hezbollah or sort of the Revolution Guard in Iran would just ask them to speed it up. So they would say, you know, if you have plans, work on them faster. Or Hezbollah, for example, might, instead of just targeting the U.S., they might target Israel. So we know, you know, there's a lot of intelligence. Hezbollah has a lot of rockets stored, and they could easily sort of start launching attacks into Israel.
Brian Lai, we know the old saying, one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. So how does the U.S. decide which group is terrorist organization?
So the U.S. has a list in which they designate terrorist organizations. And the U.S. has a very sort of specific definition in terms of the political motivations of the group and the degree to which they target civilians as well to get onto this list. And so the U.S. State Department sort of looks through international terrorists. The list is for only international terrorists, not our own domestic terrorists. It's somewhat politicized in the sense that they really focus on groups that have particular religious bents that also threaten American allies to some degree. And so that's why, for example, in Syria, al-Nusra is a group who is fighting the Assad regime that we've put on this terrorist list because they are affiliated with al-Qaeda, and they have strong ties with al-Qaeda in Iraq as well.
How much do our terrorist groups, our designated terrorist groups, that list overlap with, say, the Russians? Or
very little.
Very little.
So very little. So, you know, the Russians have a long list, and they have a lot of groups on there. They, for example, list a lot of groups that directly threaten them more.
The Chechens certainly terrorists for the Russians, but are the Chechens terrorists to us in the U.S.?
We have a few groups that are on there. We do, but sort of the list, they overlap to some degree. But for example, the Russians don't have a lot of, say, some of the traditional Palestinian groups that we list.
Now, also in Vladimir Putin's op-ed yesterday in the New York Times, he wrote this, and I wanted to see if you agree with this assessment. Syria is not witnessing a battle for democracy, but an armed conflict between government and opposition in a multi-religious country. There are few champions of democracy in Syria, but there are more than enough al-Qaeda fighters and extremists of all stripes battling the government.
That's true to some degree. I mean, the Syrian civil war is complicated in the sense that you have lots and lots of groups. I mean, to some degree, you could say hundreds of splinter groups. You have sort of the Free Syrian Army, which is a coalition of sort of former soldiers and stuff, who to some degree are promoting some democratic goals. That is, the umbrella group that they work for wants democratic Syria. But he's right. I mean, al-Nusra, which has been a very effective fighting force, there is a Syrian Islamic Front. These groups, you know, have a very different agenda. And so, you know, to some degree, the Syrian civil war is not just, you know, the Assad versus some rebel group. It's multiple rebel groups fighting in different parts of the country and really against multiple government forces. So there are a lot of state militias who were very fearful if Assad loses because many of them are Alawis. And so they're fearful if Assad loses, what's going to happen to them. So it's very complicated. And you know, so there does raise a lot of concern that if Assad falls, what happens? Because it's, you know, the Free Syrian Army and the Islamists, they don't necessarily get along. Mm-hmm. And there's a real possibility for sort of a second civil war if Assad falls.
You said hundreds of groups fighting the Assad regime. All of them would love to have the U.S. do their work and strike the Assad regime, weaken it, turn the tide in this civil war. But
well, not necessarily.
No?
So many of the Islamic groups, like al-Nusra, they don't want the U.S. to intervene. So would they – they probably would, you know, I guess secretly be okay if they got U.S. arms. But they do get arms from other countries. I mean they really have warned – I mean they've made statements saying they don't want the U.S. to intervene. They really want to keep this a very localized conflict for themselves, and they don't really want to have the U.S. intervene. Now, other groups, for example, the Free Syrian Army, they're definitely welcoming U.S. intervention. I mean, they sort of had a statement earlier this week, in which they said, you know, they want more arms, more heavier arms from the United States.
When the civil war eventually comes to an end, what do you see as possible outcomes?
It's going to be messy. I mean, you know, I guess so if Assad wins, that's a fairly easy outcome, right? So Assad somehow is able to defeat all the rebels. And what you'll have then is sort of, you know, Assad's state will probably be something akin to, you know, something you might say like a not quite as intense as Somalia, but maybe like Algeria or Yemen, where there are parts of Syria that are not fully under his control.
It will never be like it was, is what
probably you're saying. Never be like it was. I mean, there's just so much mobilization. You have such a degree of foreign influence in the region. It's hard to see it going back to what it was. The other option is that Assad loses and Assad's overthrown or he flees. In that case, it's really hard to know because the rebels are not, like I said, they're not a cohesive group. There are so many of them. They have so many competing ideologies. You know, you could see some group, some state in the region trying to broker a deal, but you have real possibility of, you know, sectarian violence like you saw in Iraq for a while. And so you really could see the possibility of sort of a second civil war emerging.
Mm-hmm. What's the best possible outcome for U.S. interests?
Well, the best possible outcome would be, you know, if Assad falls, for some coalition of states to help broker a government in which, you know, try to broker, for example, and these aren't great models, right? In Afghanistan or Iraq-style coalition democracy in which you get the Islamists on board. But, I mean, it's those are not great examples because both of those countries are still facing high degrees of violence, high degrees of instability as well. Okay. And so, I mean, Egypt is another model you could look at. But again, none of these are sort of, I guess, right now, very great models to look at.
Okay. And finally, give me the worst-case scenario for the U.S.
Worst-case scenario is you have civil war. And then the worst that's bad for the U.S.
It's what we have right now, but you mean even more.
Even more. And so you have Assad falls and you have a second civil war, in which case you have – it's clear that the conflict is between sort of these radical Islamic terrorist organizations like al-Nusra, and then you have a more sort of secular sort of groups. So for the U.S. then you really get the framed issue of, you know, do we need to intervene to prevent this from becoming sort of a state that becomes a training ground or a haven for terrorist groups?
Okay, Brian Lai, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa, specializes in terrorism and conflict process. I want to thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Coming up in just a moment, as we continue our in-depth look at the situation in Syria, we'll hear from Charles Dobbs, Professor of History at Iowa State University. Dobbs says that when it comes to the Syrian civil war, it's important to know that there isn't just one opposition, as we've been discussing here, and it isn't clear who the good guy or the bad guys are. We'll ask him what he thinks will happen the day after the Civil War. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. We're spending the hour talking about the crisis in Syria, the civil war there, how the region got to this point, what forces are at work, and what the future may hold. Welcome back to River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My next guest is Charles Dobbs, Professor of History at Iowa State University. His research and teaching interests include American diplomatic history, American military history, and modern East Asian history. Professor Dobbs, welcome to our program.
Thanks for having me.
I want to reach out to our listeners this half hour if you have some questions about Syria, the crisis going on there, also the history of the region. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. If we go back to August of 2012, Charles Dobbs, while he was running for his second term, President Obama was asked what might cause his administration to change its thoughts against military intervention in Syria. And that's when he made this notable, now notable comment about a red line in connection with chemical weapons. I wonder if we can see, if there's that much distance between now and then, that we can see that that was a mistake.
It's an interesting decision he made or announced, because the prior month in July, the Pentagon released a study indicating it would take 75,000 men, troops, to move the chemical weapons out, because it's not just the act of getting them, it's securing them against anyone trying to take them away from you, moving them safely to somewhere, probably the coast, getting them safely on board ship and so on, which is almost impossible for the United States overstretched military at the moment to find the 75,000 men. So why a month later would you draw this red line when a month earlier your own Pentagon pointed out the logistical difficulties of the action?
Do we know whether it was an off the cuff, spontaneous remark or well thought out?
I figure any parent would never do something like that, because all the parents know, you never say to your child, if I get to three, I'm going to do something, because every kid in the world stands there waiting to see what you're going to do when it's three. You've got to think it through ahead of time. And he had to have decided at the moment he made the announcement what action he would take. Mm-hmm. And it's clear from the events of the last week or so that he wasn't clear on what action he would take.
Mm-hmm. We could also say that hindsight is 20/20. If it would have prevented Assad from using chemical weapons, it would have been seen as a success, right?
If so, but his father used it against the town of Homs back in the 1980s, and there's been other allegations since. I mean, the Assad family comes from a minority tribe in Syria, and if there was ever a free vote, that tribe would likely be outvoted. The Alawites are, what, 13 to 17% of the population. They've used whatever means necessary to stay in control.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to get into that, but before that, I wanted to see, as a historian, if you see any precedent for this red line comment, because I had heard in some of the news coverage that there perhaps was one in the Cuban Missile Crisis, that then President Kennedy was asked what might be, and this is before there was any evidence of missiles in Cuba or intending to be in Cuba, Russian missiles, how he might see that, and I think he said that was unacceptable, but so that may have played a part in, a similar thing may have played a part in the Cuban Missile Crisis.
And I agree, but President Kennedy then backed off by coming up with this idea of a quarantine, which was a brilliant solution to a confrontation with the Soviets. And then none of us knew for decades that he seriously negotiated the taking away of Jupiter missiles from Italy and Turkey on Russia's border in return for Russia taking out the missile sites on our border with Cuba, which means it could all along have been an exchange that Nikita Khrushchev arranged for.
Mm-hmm. So back to the present day and the Syrian crisis, one of the fears we've been discussing is that now, having drawn the red line, that if the U.S. doesn't carry through with a strike, should it be proven that Assad, beyond all doubt, is behind the chemical weapons attacks, that other Assad and other countries like Iran, for instance, maybe not chemical, but maybe nuclear weapons, they could perceive this as the U.S. being weak. How much of a concern is that, really?
Well, it's a concern, but the problem is, so let's say we take an action, we fire cruise missiles and hit whatever we're aiming at, and the next day President Assad stands up and says, I'm still here. And I say that because in 1991, the United States and its coalition partners won one of the most amazing military victories in the history of military warfare. And yet, then President Hussein could say afterwards, I'm still here. And in the Middle East, that meant he tweaked the United States' nose, and he got credit for being there as opposed to discredit for losing 80% of his army, his tanks, his airplanes, his artillery, and everything else.
So it's a matter of expectations. You're not expected to beat the world's only superpower. You just expected you win if you survive.
You know, George Washington was what, 0-5 until Trenton?
Okay.
You know, it depends how things are perceived. And Americans are particularly bad at understanding how people around the world perceive us and our actions, because for so long we didn't have to worry about it. We were separated by broad oceans, and after, the 1820s or so, we no longer really feared Mexico or Canada as a threat to our existence.
But back to the case, if there is no strike, the concern that that would set a precedent, I wonder, do these things, a dictator sizes up the resolve of the United States and any U.S. president based on that individual case, not as a historian looking back at what the U.S. has done in the past, or?
Well, I agree that there really are no good alternatives. We could strike, but what happens if the strike doesn't accomplish anything or anything that the other side, that is Assad, admits occurred? So we strike and destroy command and control. One of the worst things that could happen is if the Syrian government loses command and control over its chemical weapons and others go raid the storehouses. Mm-hmm. And suddenly we get chemical weapons in places and with people we don't want to have. Israel gets nervous, decides to strike. Iran announces it's going to defend the Assad regime because Iran is a Shia Muslim and the Alawites, that Assad's home tribe, are Shia Muslims. And Iran then decides to strike Israel, and we suddenly have a regional war that could quickly spiral out of control.
So this is probably, would you agree, what Russian President Vladimir Putin was referring to in his op-ed in the New York Times yesterday in explaining why military action in Syria is wrong. He said, to quote, it would increase violence and unleash a new wave of terrorism.
Which he isn't just trying to be a good citizen of the world. It also threatens Russia with Chechnya and Dagestan. You know, the Russian army has acted rather brutally and certainly inflamed the passions of people in that area. And if you remember several years ago when President Bush was visiting Georgia, there was someone who threw a hand grenade and got close enough to throw the hand grenade at the president. Happily, it was wrapped up in something and did not explode.
Mm-hmm. So give us more of the Russian perspective here, Vladimir Putin, going to the people
things.
Of the United States. Yeah.
Imagine if you're a Russian leader, and it isn't that long ago to look back to the great Soviet Union, when the Soviet Union was one of the world's two superpowers, and now you're reduced greatly in terms of economic strength and ability to affect the world. And the best way you can affect the world is the trouble you can cause. So to some extent, Putin enjoys causing that degree of trouble. On the other hand, Russia, it can be said to be in a bit of a dangerous position. It's why China also is concerned, because of all the Muslim minorities in its extreme northwest. There's hundreds of thousands of cameras the government has in those northwest cities in China to watch over the local population, and they keep trying to urge Han Chinese, ethnic Chinese, to move out there to try and overwhelm the numbers. That is, they could just get enough Han Chinese out there, they dilute the number of ethnic Muslim Uyghurs.
Mm-hmm. Does that explain their actions in the UN Security Council?
Yes, it's why the Chinese government originally supported George W. Bush in Afghanistan, because of their shared, very small but still significant shared border with Afghanistan, and then got nervous afterwards because they were afraid, as the conflict seemed to spiral out of control, it might overflow into their own country.
Mm-hmm. So Russia and China and the U.S. have a common interest in a certain way in not seeing it turn into a bastion of chaos and terrorism.
I agree. We just don't have a common way to get there. Mm-hmm. Because Putin has said, and I assume he believes it, that he sees an awful lot of American actions as an attempt to establish American hegemony over the world, and areas in particular where the Soviet Union used to have a significant role to play.
Mm-hmm. Looking at the U.S. history and Putin in history, do you see this latest move by Russia as a ploy to delay or as a real attempt at peacemaking here?
I think it's both, and I think it's brilliant. That is, if one stands back, probably the only way to defuse the situation is what President Putin did. And there's no way, if it works out, that Russia doesn't look better in the eyes of the world. And if it doesn't work out, he probably can blame somebody else and still take credit. Mm-hmm. It's a really sharp thing. I mean, every now and then you have to say they played their hand well. And they played their hand really well.
Okay. You've got Russia and Putin painted as a no-lose situation, it seems, almost. What about President Obama? You said the red line was a mistake. How might he, though, be seen in historical perspective if this works out?
Well, obviously, President Obama, when he was running for office, hoped to make his mark domestically and withdraw from the two wars that his predecessor got the U.S. into and not have to deal with these kinds of things. And it doesn't play to one of his strengths, because his strength is not foreign policy, which is perfectly fine. You can't do everything well. I don't see how things can work out really well for President Obama, for the United States, for American foreign policy, for the American people in all of this. There's other issues, too. I mean, Turkey and Saudi Arabia have tried for 2 years to find an opposition leader, basically to rally around, to create either an alternate regime or to try and overthrow the Assad family. And in 2 years' time, they can't find a significant opposition leader who has a reasonable amount of support among the Syrian people, or even the Syrian people who are in rebellion. There's hundreds of different groups. That's the real problem. The only stability is Assad, which is an awful, violent, deadly stability, but it's the only stability.
Do these groups have a common view of U.S. and the possible U.S. intervention?
No. I mean, some of the groups are moderate and not particularly religious. Some of the groups are more radical. Some of the groups have other issues. I mean, that is, there might be – Syria has a small Kurdish population, as does Turkey. So does Iraq and Iran. And even going back to Woodrow Wilson and the Versailles Peace Conference, the Kurdish people asked for territorial self-determination, since that was one of Wilson's famous 14 points, and they were denied. I mean, most people may have heard of the Crusades, but they don't know that Saladin was a Kurd, not an Arab, when he defeated Richard III and threw out the Crusaders and restored the Holy Land to Muslim control. Mm-hmm. And so there's all these different groups, all with different goals and different purposes. So one of your previous, the political science professor at Iowa, he absolutely right, talked about there's a chance for a division perhaps of the country. The Kurds would like to see all their minority areas put together into one Kurdistan buoyed by the oil wealth in northwest Iraq.
If you just joined us, Charles Dobbs is my guest, professor of history at Iowa State University. If you'd like to join our conversation as we discuss the Syria crisis, the Syrian civil war, with any aspects you feel are unclear or ones you'd like to ask questions about, 1-866-780-9100. We're also on Facebook. Tweet us at IPR Talk, or good old email is fine too, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Charles Dobbs, Eric on our Facebook page asks, could you also outline some of the U.S.'s interests in the country?
Our interests are different. One, of course, we don't want the spread of weapons that others can get a hold of, particularly new and very dangerous weapons. It's why we try to curtail atomic technology, because neither the Soviets nor the Americans, and more recently the British, the French, and the Chinese, have ever used nuclear weapons. And it doesn't appear that we would, but who knows about anyone else? It's the same thing then with these deadly chemical weapons. And the same way that Syria has not signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty for Chemical Weapons, nor has Israel. And the one won't sign till the other, and neither of them trust each other enough probably to sign. So our interests are, one, to, in some ways, to make sure that the world isn't a deadlier place than it is. We also want to support our allies. Turkey's a NATO ally. Israel's an ally of long standing. Saudi Arabia is an ally. And all of them could be threatened in different ways by however this plays out in Syria.
Talk a little bit more about Israel's concerns here, their position, especially since President Obama turned to Congress for approval there. Now, he's delayed that, but he did turn to Congress and ask for approval.
Well, the Israeli leadership is really worried that the business in Syria is diverting the United States and the world from Iran, that Israel's real concern is nuclear weapons. And at the moment, it appears, the world has turned away from watching Iranian progress towards nuclear arms, and instead is focusing on the situation in Syria, which, of course, makes sense. The millions of refugees, the 100,000 dead, the 1,400 children, and everything else. But to the Israelis, the real fear is Iran, and it's possible they might feel if the world isn't taking care of their interests, they may choose to act. And that also would make for a general conflagration. Last year, Israel and Azerbaijan signed an arrangement, and it didn't make any sense why the two negotiated this sort of diplomatic arrangement until one figures that the American-supplied planes the Israelis have could fly from Israel, bomb Iran, and make it to Azerbaijan, which is nearby, though they couldn't make it back to Israel. And it starts getting people nervous. Were the Israelis actually thinking about some kind of raid? Now, nothing's happened. It doesn't mean they're not thinking about it.
1-866-780-9100. Ed is joining us, listening in Martinsdale. Hi, Ed. What's your question?
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Yeah, I've got a question about this recent news that just came out about the CIA supplying a lot of weapons to the anti-Assad regime. And I wondered what your guest knows about that, how many dollars worth, and which factions are those weapons going to?
And
who's making money off of it?
Well, and that's a really good question. And in part, it's a really good question because trained troops would not use weaponry the same way that guerrillas would. And I say that because you could fire a clip on an M16 or an AK-47 in about as much time as I said to say fire a clip. So it takes a lot of ammunition if you're firing weapons. If we start giving them anti-aircraft weapons, some of those people might aim those weapons at other places. We have been nervous for some time about anti-aircraft weapons supplied to the Mujahideen in Afghanistan back in the 1980s under President Reagan, though the odds are 30 years later they deteriorated enough they're not a threat. So there's one, who we supply the weapons to, that also forces us to resupply because the ammunition of whatever kind of weapon gets used up quickly. It may cause more violence. Assad has more than one army division in his army, and he's really only committed one army division to this fight. So if we expand the civil war by arming the rebels, he might then expand the civil war by committing yet another army division, and the death toll goes up.
Mm-hmm. You said he's only committed a third of his army. Why, when his very existence is at threat, has he not pulled out all the stops?
Well, what if Turkey or Israel or Turkey and Israel, backed by the Saudis, decide to do something? The Israelis are on the Golan Heights. The Turks have been building dams both to control water in southeast Turkey to be able to improve the lives of their people. But if they turn off the water, it literally affects Syrian agriculture because the dams fill up and there's no flow in the rivers. The Iraqis have the same fear because the Turks are building dams on the rivers that feed the Tigris and Euphrates.
Wow. There are so many moving parts in this story.
Yes, sir. Life is really complicated, and this is a particularly complicated part of the world.
Jim is with us in Cedar Rapids. Jim, we're running out of time, but do you have a question or comment?
Yes, real quick. It just seems to me that through a lack of education and through the years of war that the country has had to endure and, you know, the lack of leadership we had and you know, all of the lies that we had to live through, you know, through the last 12 years of war, I think the country seems to be turning back to a point where they just want to isolate themselves, and people are just wanting to turn their heads and not worry about things anymore and think that, you know, we're far away, let's just not worry about it. And I think that that is a dangerous road for the citizens of America to start to go down again, because we found ourselves in real trouble right before World War II because of the isolationist views of America. And so I think we need to be really careful not to turn our heads and just say, you know, let's see what happens, let it play out. I think we really need to get some sort of a plan and get things taken care of, because we're just letting things get too far out of hand.
Okay, Jim, thank you. In Cedar Rapids, I wonder, as a historian, Charles Dobbs, if you see this isolationist tendency that we have as more than a blip on the radar, comparable to something we had a few times in the 20th century.
That's a really good question. One of my professors in graduate school, so we're talking 40 years ago, spent several years trying to write a history of American isolationism, gave up and wrote an incredibly well-regarded article, How Come You Couldn't Write a History of American Isolationism, because of the definition. We trade with the world. People go back and forth. Our music either goes abroad or music comes here. Movies go both ways. We adopt game shows from around the world. And all other kinds of ways, food ways and everything else. I mean, what is American cuisine now? It's the cuisine of the world.
So you can't answer that question, I guess.
It gets really tough. But I do agree that it's dangerous if we start to say we're not interested in world events and we'd rather not try and define what our interests are. And part of the problem is that it's very easy for people to turn away. As if you do surveys of what are the major problems in the world and ask the American people to fill it out, you've seen those, I've seen those, foreign policy is never near the top. Bringing home the troops could be near the top, but general foreign relations, we ought to understand what's going on in the world, is never a top concern to the American people. It's just bozos like me who like to get published.
Charles Dobbs. You were a professor of history at ISU. I would never call you a bozo. I guess you can describe yourself any way you like. But let's have you finish up the hour giving us the best and worst case scenarios you see going forward for Syria and the region.
To me, the best case scenario is that the Russian regime is really serious about their proposal, that Assad may be in a bit more trouble than I think he is, and he agrees to turn over the weaponry in return for some concessions we probably worry about, both from the United States and from Russia.
Why not?
Well, because it's like the American people didn't know that Kennedy did a tit-for-tat with Khrushchev about withdrawing the Jupiter missiles from Turkey and Italy. Even though he withdrew them, he said he'll do it later, so it didn't look like it was a trade. And we didn't know that for a very long time. We didn't know after the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan that the Chinese allowed Jimmy Carter's administration to establish listening posts in Western China, because the Chinese had the same concerns we did about Soviet expansion into Central Asia.
Okay, so a deal done behind closed doors. We don't find out about it for perhaps decades?
Which doesn't bother me. There,
okay,
there's a public right to know and a public right not to know. That's the best case scenario. The worst case...
Yeah, we've got about a minute left.
...is that the Assad regime falls apart and Syria breaks down into all its constituent parts with all the different fighting groups, and it makes Saudi Arabia, Israel, and Turkey dangerous enough that we start seeing regional clash of powers, which will inevitably draw in if not the great powers, the great suppliers of military hardware.
Mm, okay. And so spreading throughout the region.
Right.
And involving a lot of our troops.
It's a very destabilized region at the moment, as everybody knows, whether it's Libya, Egypt, threats to Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Yemen.
Mm. Charles Dobbs, this has been very informative. I want to thank you for coming to our studio and talking with us about it. We'll, I think, check in with you again as we get further on down the line. Hopefully it looks a little better than it does now.
Thank you very much.
Charles Dobbs, professor of history at Iowa State University. Research and teaching interests including American diplomatic history, American military history, and modern East Asian history. River to River is produced by Sarah Bowden, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Technical support from Dennis Reese in Ames today. Help from Jason Burns and Garrett Van Leeuwen. And the executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. Our theme music written and performed by the River Monks. Tomorrow on this program, oh, we're going to do another news buzz. That's where we flit from one news topic to the next. Some of the loose ends that we haven't talked about in the news this week. I hope you'll join us tomorrow on River to River. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.